Support for the Exchange Podcast from NHPR comes from you, our listeners,
and from the New Hampshire Department of Agriculture, Markets, and Food. New Hampshire's farms and farmers markets are full of fresh goods, rich with agricultural heritage, and available all year long. You can locate pick-your-own farms, farmers markets, fairs, and more near you using the directories at visitnh.gov/agriculture.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. The humble fungi family is finally getting some respect. Earlier this fall, a United Nations-backed report by more than 100 researchers from around the world said fungi could help solve some of humanity's most pressing problems, including climate change. Meanwhile, here in New Hampshire, familiar fungi are easy to spot. Mushrooms on the forest floor, lichen on rocks and trees. But it's what we don't see that really could hold powerful potential. Vast networks of fungi underground, which support a network of life up above. Today in The Exchange, why scientists right now are excited about these organisms, many of which we can't even see. We'll find out more, and let's hear from you. Your questions, comments, and of course your own observations about fungi are welcome. Our email, exchange@nhpr.org. Again, exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange, or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. We have two guests with us. Dave Anderson is here, Senior Director of Education at the Forest Society and co-host of NHPR's Something Wild. Dave, thank you for coming in.
Thanks.
Really appreciate it. Snowy day, and I know you had a trip, so thank
Thanks,
you for
Laura.
Being here. Also with us, Rick Van de Paul. He's an amateur mycologist, which means he studies mushrooms. He's president of the Northeast Mycological Federation, and Rick is also principal of Ecosystem Management Consultants. And Rick, thank you also for coming in. I know you had some snow and sandwich, so I really appreciate
Good
it.
Good morning, Laura.
So one researcher at Boston University described fungi as a quirky group, both beautiful and bizarre. Rick, you first, what do you think? How would you best describe fungi?
Mysterious and largely unknown. We have at least 120 or 30,000 known species, but they estimate 3.8 million species worldwide. So we know very little relative to the number of species in the world.
Yeah, and it's often described as a vast kingdom. So that's what you're getting at, Rick, right? It's vast.
Absolutely.
In terms of the number of species. Yeah, go ahead.
There are very few habitats that do not have fungi, and it's surprising when you look, you will find them wherever you are. So,
do they grow in very cold climates? Like, would there be fungi in Antarctica?
Yes, there are.
See, that's amazing. I think of them as sort of wet and moist and...
Indeed. But then what happens, of course, is that they adapt to different climatic conditions. And this has been going on for millions of years. So you might find fungi on mountaintops that perhaps are lichenized, that is to say in the form of a lichen, which, as you know, is part fungus and part alga. But you also can find them at the edge of the sea. The most common mushroom is lichenized. That black zone on the edge of the intertidal zone is a lichen, and that is too. Part fungus.
So, Dave, I've also heard fungi described as, there's lots of really great descriptions out there. Besides beautiful and bizarre, I've heard them called soil magicians. I've heard them called Earth's natural internet. I've heard them called like stomachs and lungs for the Earth, kind of taking in nutrients and breathing out air or whatever. How would you best describe fungi?
I think that's all. I like the nervous system analogy, but it's strictly an analogy. But I think people are trying to define the role that they play, because it's only recently that people are understanding how important soil fungi are into functioning forests. And I've learned a lot from Rick, including that, you know, it can extend the root zone 100 times, and that trees cannot thrive or grow as we know them without their fungal partners called the mycorrhiza, which is one of the three principal groups that we can talk about today. But it's really important. Somebody once said, you know, we should explore the microscopic wilderness in a single teaspoon of forest soil in our own backyard. And it's amazing how much we do not know.
So just map that out for us a little bit more, the importance of fungi, Dave, to this healthy forest floor.
Well, so Rick can help me with this too, but I've learned a lot about mycorrhizal fungi that live in the forest and actually embedded within the root hairs of the largest trees. And we think of these huge, think about a 150-foot tall white pine, and it has an incredible network embedded within the sheath around the root hairs. And that is a place for exchange where the fungus is getting sugars, carbohydrates, and in exchange, it's providing minerals, nutrients, and increasing the efficiency of uptake of things like water and nutrients and minerals so that the tree can thrive. It's almost like a natural engine that helps to pump nutrients and water into the tree and help the tree thrive. And without it, these trees do not do well.
So it's interesting. It sounds like it's almost part of the tree, but it's not. It's a separate organism.
Yes. Yeah.
Indeed. It's part of a symbiotic relationship that's been going on for hundreds of millions of years. And in short, if there's one term that I like to teach my students, mycorrhiza, and follow that with the statement that without mycorrhiza on the planet, we as a species would not be here.
Wow. Okay. You got to give me more on that. That's fascinating.
Yeah. Well, you've got basically an organism that provides the nutrient cycling, breaking down organic matter and providing it in little bits that can be uptaken by other organisms. And if you don't recycle those carbon compounds, you cannot provide the assimilation needed for the diversity of life as we know it. So that has adapted for, well, over 400 million years and has provided all of the ecosystem types that we know today. There are hundreds of different types of ecosystems, all of which have fungi as the basic building block of those systems.
So without fungi, we're toast, basically.
We're toast. Exactly.
Go ahead, Dave.
Well, and also, you know, I think people, we've already done a deep dive into the forest soil. We're exploring the microscopic wilderness now and what we're talking about. But I think fungi have a bad PR rep. People think of them as molds that, you know, are harmful in our houses, and there's fungicides that we fight them. And so at best, they're creepy. And, you know, at worst, they're somehow malicious. And so
you got to scrub them away with some bleach.
Right. So fungi need a better PR agent. On the good side, though, we either see them as something that's potentially like parasitizing, rotting, helping things to rot. And so we think of them in the sort of that death zone. But on the good side, you know, there are some that are delicious and we like to eat. And so we see the mushrooms. And that's like the finest thing for most people is, oh, there's the mushroom. What's it doing? Can I eat it? And then they turn their attention elsewhere. So the vast majority of the kingdom is the unseen microscopic little threads, the hyphae, that are growing in the soil. So we went right into the unseen, but I think what most people never get there. They're thinking about what they see.
Well, and I definitely want to ask you guys about the mushrooms. Let's face it, mushrooms are kind of having a moment now with the local food movement. We're going to talk a little bit later with a chef who forages. And Rick, you can tell us about some of your foraging as well. But it is really interesting to talk about this unknown network because, as I said earlier, the United Nations backed a report recently that said this network, these amazing organisms, could help us with climate change, even help clean up all those nasty plastics that we know are in the oceans. We should definitely talk about that as well. I also want to remind our listeners that you can join us. We'd love to hear from you, your questions, comments, observations, 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Again, exchange@nhpr.org. You can respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. And I really encourage everybody to check out our web post for today. There's a lot more information. There's some photos. And there's a great TED Talk there, too, about fungi. Our website is nhpr.org/exchange. So check that out. So on this theme that you mentioned, Dave, seen and unseen. So when you walk in the forest, obviously you see mushrooms, and we'll talk about those a little bit later. But what are some other fungi that your average person might notice if they were paying a little bit more attention?
Oh, slime molds, something called witch's butter, which they've reclassified. These gooey, jelly-like substances. There are
on a tree or?
Yeah, or in the soil or rotting wood. There's a patina of like a glaze over a lot of wood that's decomposing that we don't think of as mushrooms. It's just sort of a color. It's a mat, a fungal mat. And it's doing its work. It's growing, it's spreading, it's decomposing the carbohydrates and the breaking down the carbons in that wood and recycling. If nothing else, they are tremendous recyclers.
Kind of like we hear insects are, you know, helping to recycle some of that.
And then a really basic thing is people picking mushrooms, people will, now you've removed something, but it's like picking an apple from a tree. You haven't disturbed the tree. You've just removed a fruiting body. And mushrooms are the fruiting bodies of the unseen fungal mycelia, the network of threads that are in the soil. And when the conditions are right, they will send up a mushroom. And Rick told me this year, I mean, this year was incredible, and I don't fully understand that.
Yeah, incredible in terms of the mushrooms that you find in the forest?
Yeah, so normal season for mushrooms running from about early May to the end of October. When there's rain, there is usually mushrooms. Even in the wintertime, you can have a thaw in February and have oyster mushrooms pop out on a sugar maple on the roadside, which is fantastic for those of us that love to eat oyster mushrooms. I actually brought some today. I have a little basket full.
Where did you get those, Rick?
Oh, I got those off of a stump in Maine about a week ago, and that was during another heavy rainstorm.
Dave's eating them on the air. I just want folks to know that.
So if Dave gets really quiet.
That's all right. It'll take a few hours to take effect.
I trust you, Rick.
Yeah. So oyster mushrooms are just one of many. And, of course, you have at least 300 to 400 species that are commonly known that are edible mushrooms, but you have a number that are poisonous as well.
Well, people always ask about that, so
really go ahead. You need to know which mushroom you're eating, and it's best to go out with an expert or consult a good field guide. I brought another one here today with me, and on the website there's a number of others that would be posted. But nonetheless, it's really good to have someone who knows more than you do, who you trust, that can advise you on whether or not something is edible.
Someone who's not holding a secret grudge against you.
Yeah, or not in your will.
Yeah.
Or that kind of thing.
So, but what about the non-mushrooms, okay? Because, again, we want to educate folks that, yeah, there's mushrooms, and yeah, they're out there, and yeah, we all see them. And as I said, we're going to talk a little bit later with a chef who uses them and forages. But what other fungi, Rick, are out there in your average New Hampshire forest if you just look a little harder?
Well, perhaps you mentioned lichens before, and they are fantastic examples of another type of symbiosis between algae, who provide the sugar, and fungi. And, of course, lichens, for example, in the Pacific Northwest provide an incredible amount of nitrogen. The cyanobacterial component of the lichens out there, particularly one species, Lobaria, which is they call the lungwort lichen, actually fixes upwards of 2.2 kilograms of nitrogen per hectare in the forests of the Pacific Northwest. Now, that's providing an incredible benefit to all of the trees, all the organisms that depend upon nitrogen, and this is just one of many lichens that do that throughout the world.
Wow, I feel bad. I just sort of, you know, pass them by in the forest. I should have at least said thank you.
Of course. There are over 40,000 species of lichens worldwide that we know of, and that represents a good third of the mushrooms that that we do have good identification for.
And when you're hiking in the White Mountains, look at the rocks around the summits, or even when you get to an AMC hut in the wintertime, you can look at the side, the stone versus the lime mortar between the rocks, and you'll see an entire universe of colors of different lichens that are growing in little microhabitats on the side of a stone building above treeline in New Hampshire's White Mountains.
Yeah, again, I've seen them, but never really thought about it
next
before.
Time.
So next time, there you go. And again, I was mentioning earlier that Rick brought in a bunch of different mushrooms and mushroom dishes, and Dave was tasting one of them. If you want to look at them, Jessica Hunt, our producer, put some pictures on Instagram, and later on they'll be on Twitter and our web post. But they're on Instagram right now if you want to check them out. It's NHPR Exchange. Let's go to our listeners, gentlemen. Again, we're taking your questions and comments about the amazing world of fungi. Learning a lot here. It goes way beyond mushrooms and lichen. We're finding out more. We'd love your questions and comments and, of course, your own observations. So join us, 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. And from Hudson, guys, Michelle is calling in. Hi, Michelle. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi there. Can you hear me okay? I'm on my Bluetooth.
Yes, that's fine. You should turn your radio down if you've got that going on, Michelle.
I don't. It's off.
Okay.
So this fall, for the first time ever, in our very wooded backyard, we found what we're calling snow mold. Literally, it looked like a light dusting of snow, or maybe if you're going to roll a pie crust out on your counter and you throw a bunch of flour, maybe looks like that. It was sort of granular but smooth, and we researched it. We had Gene Harrington from the Farmers Exchange in Nashua come look at it, and nobody can figure out what it is.
Wow. Michelle, do you have a picture of it that you could send us?
At home, yes, but
okay.
I'm driving.
All right. No, and I don't want you to do that now. Absolutely. But got some activity going on our web post and so forth. But can you help her out, Rick?
Yeah,
snow
so
mold.
That,
what a good name.
Michelle, what substrate was it growing on?
There was a tree there that fell in the big Halloween storm, what, 6-7 years ago?
Yep.
And so the tree stump is gone, but the roots are still in the ground and they are definitely rotting. We get a lot of fungus coming up, mushroomy looking things, almost colonies. My grandson likes to stomp them.
Well, I would suggest that you look up coral slime when you get to your nearest website and check that out. Coral slime is something that grows on wood, and it looks like a white mold, kind of fuzzy when it first starts out, and then develops this very fine sort of armature to each of the fruiting bodies. And you might look at that. That's one suggestion. But keep in mind that all of the mycelium that inhabits wood and rotting leaves, for example, starts out as a white fuzzy mold. And if you peel back bark, any type of tree will do, you'll see that white fuzzy mold growing underneath the bark, and that will ultimately depend upon the conditions, turn into some type of fruiting body. But check that out, coral slime, it might help.
All right, Michelle, thank you for the call. Again, you can join us, 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Again, exchange@nhpr.org. You know, guys, I keep hearing that fungi are actually more like animals than plants. I mean, you look at a mushroom, for example, looks like a plant. You pick it, you eat it. Rick, you first, but Dave, I want to hear from you too. How are fungi more like animals, you know, cats, dogs, people, than plants?
They're closer to animals than plants, actually. They have cell walls that are made up of certain types of carbohydrates that, for example, chitin is very common. Chitin is the substance you usually associate with insect shells or insect wings type of material. There's also a defined, or what they call a eukaryotic cell that has a defined nucleus. You have a number of different types of chromosomes that are very similar to animals, other types of organisms that
so
are
more
animal-like.
So at the cellular structure.
At the very cellular structure. And, of course, they're, you know, they're heterothallic. They have many different shapes like animals do, and they don't necessarily move. But if you look at certain types of fungi, they do have a modal state, and that would
right.
be...
Right, so a spore that can actually move like a microscopic tadpole, right?
But that's... I would say they're closer in terms of their chemistry to animals, but they still have some sort of plant-like characteristics as well, sort of in between.
All right. Lots more to talk about after a short break. And we'll keep taking your questions and comments and your observations. 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. Again, exchange@nhpr.org. Coming up, more about fungi and scientific excitement around their potential as biological cleanup agents. Stay with us. This is The Exchange on NHPR.
Tuesday is a chance for you to celebrate the organizations that benefit your community by giving back. And today, when you donate to NHPR, you can extend your generosity by giving meals to the New Hampshire Food Bank. Contribute $10 a month and pay forward your thank you gift. Instead of choosing a mug or t-shirt, choose to give 10 meals to the food bank. Give today and pay it forward at nhpr.org. And thank you for your support.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today, the secret life of fungi and why a recent scientific report said unlocking those secrets could be hugely beneficial to humankind. We're finding out more, and let's hear from you. Your questions, comments, observations, send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Again, exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange, or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. And I really encourage you to check out our web post for today. There's more information. There's great photos. There's a fascinating TED Talk on fungi, so check it out. Our website is nhpr.org/exchange. Our guests are Dave Anderson, Senior Director of Education at the Forest Society and co-host of NHPR's Something Wild. Also with us, Rick Vandepaul. He's an amateur mycologist, which means he studies mushrooms. He's president of the Northeast Mycological Federation and principal of Ecosystem Management Consultants. One more time, that phone number for you to join us, 1-800-892-6477. So, both of you, I've been alluding to this. I want to hit it head on. This big United Nations report just a couple weeks ago saying fungi, of all things, could play a role in alleviating or at least helping put off the worst effects of climate change. Both of you, but you first, Rick, how do molds and lichen and mushrooms do that?
Fixing carbon.
Yeah. So.
And so when you look at, say, a tree root, and you have all these mycorrhizal threads and the mycelia that's associated with it, you have upwards of 8 to 10 times the amount of biomass surrounding or within the tree root than you have actually plant material. So when you think about an underground ecosystem, most of it's fungi in terms of the active biota. Of course, there are a lot of other organisms.
Active biota means what?
Active biological organisms. You have a lot of bacteria, and a lot of microbes, and so forth. But in terms of the bulk of it, it's fungi. So, of course, growing a tree, keeping it alive, keeping it growing, you're actually growing the underground forest, if you will.
I like that.
Rather than growing the above ground, because the biomass is much larger underground than it is above ground.
The underground.
Underground
forest.
Biomass.
That's a great way to put it. Yeah. So, and Dave, just remind us that there is a role that trees and forests play in mitigating climate change, but, you know, just kind of walk us
through
how that works.
Trees are carbon. Trees are fixing carbon every day. They're, through the process of photosynthesis and growth, are taking atmospheric carbon and sequestering it. Sucking it up and locking it up in wood, and then it gets broken down in the soil when the trees rot. I'm reading a quote from one study. It says, the amount of carbon coming out of the soil is roughly 10 times larger annually than the amount of carbon coming out of human processes in the land.
When you say coming out of, what do you mean?
Being released to the atmosphere, or fixed in the soil, or involved in being taken up by fungi. So if anything affects the soil environment, that microscopic wilderness, that potentially has a huge impact on atmospheric carbon, which is the chief component of global climate change.
So just to put it really simply, trees, Dave, and this soil supported by fungi are sucking up carbon and keeping it locked in place.
Yes.
Until the tree is chopped down.
Yep. And then actually still breaking it down and releasing it and making it available to other life forms that are growing.
So I know, you know, I don't know, a decade ago, 2 decades ago, maybe even 3 decades ago, Dave, there was a lot of interest in, you know, trees are going to save us and let's all plant a tree and
trees are absolutely going to save
us. And reduce, you know, and we can combat climate change just by planting more trees. But I have, in later years, I have heard that, you know, maybe trees help, but there's so much carbon out there being emitted by factories and homes and cars that it's really takes a lot more than
that. It turns out there's a lot of carbon in the soil. There's also a lot of carbon in the oceans. And so you can't just look at one thing and say, well, is it the forest or is it the oceans or is it the soil? It's the entire system and the way it interacts. And it's so complex that, you know, biogeochemists are working on trying to figure this out and make a budget for the planet for carbon. We're certainly tilting the budget through the work that, you know, we're doing on the planet.
Now, you may not know the answer to this, but I'm going to ask you anyway. And it's fine if you don't know the answer. If people all of a sudden said, okay, trees are going to do it. Let's plant, you know, twice as many trees as we have now. Would that make a big difference, a small difference? Do we know?
It would make a difference. It would be a positive thing. But which trees? What are their ages? What are their rates of growth? How fast are they accruing and accumulating and sequestering carbon? Is a young forest of saplings and seedlings actually doing more to pull carbon out of the atmosphere and fix it into wood? Or are very, very large old trees doing that? And so we get into these discussions, and I think that there's a lot of work going on, some really important work here in New Hampshire at the Hubbard Brook Experimental Forest that has looked into the budgets for carbon and the rates of growth of forest. And that productivity, if the forest is alive and growing, it's certainly better than a parking lot or a front lawn or a curb or a driveway or a rooftop. And so when we're looking at this, the alternative, I mean, if you're going to simplify it, it's a forest or it's not a forest. A forest is good because it's working to absorb and purify water. And it's just a laundry list of ecosystem services that are not provided by developed landscapes, hardscape, where we live. The kind of habitats that we make for ourselves are not necessarily helping out natural processes.
And then again, bringing in the fungi that we've been talking about, Rick, Those forests that are so helpful that Dave describes are supported by, undergirded by, really can't survive without the fungi,
Absolutely.
The underground forest.
When you think about a forest, you have carbon in a variety of different forms, in a variety of different places. And when you look at, say, forest management, the optimal consideration for storing carbon is to provide all of that diversity of places where carbon can be stored. So you're looking at downed woody debris, you're looking at branch tops, you're looking at the humus layer on top of the mineral soil, and of course you're looking at all the fungi underneath the surface of the ground. Having all of those will provide the greatest benefit to the ecosystem.
Do fungi in and of themselves soak up carbon the way trees do?
Absolutely.
Or do they do it indirectly through the tree?
No, absolutely. Their basic building block is composed of carbon. When you think about a basic carbohydrate, it is a carbon-based chain polymer. That's a long chain molecule, okay? And that is the building block of the fungi that are optimizing these downed and decaying pieces of wood to grow and then produce every so often tasty mushrooms.
Well, so if people say plant a tree, save the earth, you can say plant some mushrooms.
Absolutely.
Save the earth. Let's go back to our listeners, guys, and then a lot more to talk about, including some of the edible mushrooms that you brought in today, Rick. And if you want to see pictures, check out our Instagram. It's NHPR Exchange. The number for you to join us right now, we'd love to have you in our conversation, 1-800-892-6477. Email is great, exchange@nhpr.org. Facebook or Twitter is NHPR Exchange. Jerry in Dover sent us an email. He says, I grew up with grandparents who were Italian immigrants, and when I was very young, we would go on mushroom picking forays in the woods that surrounded our summer camp in Massachusetts. Today, Jerry says, I feel very fortunate that I survived those times because the rule of thumb that my grandfather used as to whether or not a mushroom should be harvested was, any mushroom growing on clear ground was good. If the mushroom was growing near trash, it was not to be picked. Jerry says, fortunately, none of my extended family was ever poisoned, which today I find amazing. Wow, Rick.
Yep.
What about Grandpa's advice?
Yeah, not so good.
Oh.
He got lucky. A lot of people think, for example, that only mushrooms that grow on wood are edible. There's an old wives' tale that says if you put a silver dollar or a silver quarter in a pot of boiling water and it turns black with the mushrooms, it's poisonous. That doesn't work. And then, of course, there's the adage that if you have a boli, which is one of those spongy bottom mushrooms, the sape, the stein pelts, that porcini, for example, if you have those that have red undersides that stain blue, they're poisonous. And yet one of the best edible boletes is just that, red underneath, staining blue when you touch it.
So, see, I had heard that if it's a bright, interesting color, that was nature's way of saying don't eat it.
That is absolutely not true.
Okay.
Caesar knew better because he named Caesar's mushroom after a bright red Amanita. So,
well, Jerry, thank you for the story. Again, you can send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Again, exchange@nhpr.org. Okay, another.
One more thing I really like about that is the cultural reference that he had an Italian grandparents.
Right.
A lot of times, people who I've met who know an awful lot about mushrooms learn from their parents and grandparents, Eastern Europeans, Slavic cultures. Mushrooms are huge. And in the United States, I think people don't have that It's really an immigrant thing, and I've learned a lot about people who know a lot about mushrooms, mycophiles who love mushrooms, and that came from their cultural heritage.
Well, and as we talk about climate change, I was reading an article just recently, Dave, that some drought in Eastern Europe where they love truffles, and Western Europe too, that it is hurting truffle production because the soil is too dry.
Yeah.
So truffle is fungi.
Yes.
Truffle is a fungus, indeed.
Absolutely.
It's an underground fungus. And it's interesting because these fungi have adapted to dry climates, chronically dry climates, to grow largely underground and fruit underground. And then, of course, the question is, well, how do you get an underground mushroom, which is the fruiting body again, from one place to another? Pigs?
Chipmunks?
Dogs? But really, chipmunks, squirrels, small mammals, those that live underneath the ground.
Oh, why do pigs always get all the credit?
Well, they started out because they have good noses and they're smart.
And they can smell them
and
out.
You can train them.
Oh, and they're domesticated and so they can go, and go find it for people, whereas you can't really train a chipmunk.
But if you go to Italy today, most of the truffle hunting animals are dogs.
Okay, another thing that I should have known, but I'm not quite sure. Rick, I'll throw this to you. Cheese? Is cheese fungi?
Mold is a fungus. Roper. Absolutely.
Blue cheese. All the cheese.
Bread. Yeast is a fungus. It's Ascomycete. You have wine. You have yeast. Those are fungi.
Beer.
Think of all the food and the fun that we've had.
With
the
fungi.
Backs of fungi.
Lots of people emailing with questions and comments. It's great. So keep them coming. Exchange at nhpr.org. A little bit earlier in the show, we talked about how do you define fungi? Is it more like a plant? Is it more like an animal? Kevin sent us an email. He's supervisory plant physiologist with the U.S. Forest Society. He says, as a fungal physiologist, I suggest not to think so much that fungi, the Eumycota, are closer to animals or to plants, but that they are 100% fungi. So don't define them, as he seems to be saying. Don't define them. Are they more like animals? Are they more like plants? They're just their own. They're their own thing. Like your mother always said, you're special in your own way.
But you know, it wasn't until the 50s that that was actually really understood.
Right.
So it's recent.
Tell us a little bit more about that. That's interesting because you're right. We used to sort of define everything. Is it animal? Is it plant? If it isn't, then, you know, forget it.
I mean, we've had mushrooms that were named since Linnaean times in the 1750s. And for 200 years, they were considered in the plant kingdom. And they were, in fact, called thallophytes, and different types of fungi were given the same division organization as the plants. But, in fact, they are their own kingdom, and thankful to Bryce Kendrick and others who wrote a book called The Fifth Kingdom, recognizing them as a separate entity. So I agree with your caller, emailer.
All right. Thank you so much for that. And let's take a call. This is Wayne in Berlin. Hi, Wayne. You're on the air. Thanks for being with us.
Yeah, hi. I was wondering if there was any protected species of mushrooms.
Wow, that's a really great question, Wayne. I appreciate that. In 1996, I sponsored a conference in Scutney, Vermont called Conserving Mycological Diversity. And at the time, the goal was to identify rare fungi and see if we could add them to this, say, endangered species list or something like that. In Washington State and Oregon, there are two species of fungi that are considered rare. They're actually state listed. It's not legal to pick them. Even though they have fruiting bodies and underground fungi, that you cannot pick them. Those are the only states so far. We have two other states that have lichens that are listed, but very, very little is known about how rare fungi are. We're just getting going on the International Red List. That is the list that provides an idea of what the rarest species in the world is. And I am fortunate to be on the North American Committee for the International Red List.
Well, and it's a great question, Wayne, and it sounds like, guys, it's not really one we can answer because, as you both said earlier, there could be up to 3.8 million species of fungi globally, and we've only recognized, you know, a couple hundred thousand.
Yeah,
so, yeah,
exactly.
So you can't really answer Wayne's question, can you, Dave?
No, not if you don't know where they are and what they're doing.
Right.
Rick helped me understand breaking down the mushrooms into three broad categories and basically said, look, there's saprophytes, there are parasites, and there are the mycorrhizae that we talked about that are helping out. So, Rick, I wonder if you could talk about the difference between saprophytes and parasites, because that's a little
Yeah, well, that's simple. Saprophytes are those fungi that break down dead and decaying material. So things that are already gone, as it were, have expressed themselves.
Which is very helpful.
Yeah.
Think about walking
through the woods without decomposing fungi. It'd be a little tough.
Okay, so the first category we talked about, sorry to interrupt, but just to make it crystal clear for folks, the first category we talked about is the category that, pronounce it for me again.
Saprophyte.
No, the one begins with M.
Mycorrhizae.
Those are the ones that assist plants and trees in the forest in
It's the living soil.
Okay, getting the nutrients that they need and so forth. Right. So this is a second kind that is more of a decomposer.
Yep, all the polypores, the oyster mushroom that I have in front of me, all of these types of mushrooms are saprophytes. Then, of course, you have some that actually start growing on living organisms. Can be humans, can be trees, can be all kinds of plants. And those are parasites. Those are actually not benefiting the host, and they're breaking down living material as they do so. Shoestring rot is a classic example, otherwise known as armillaria or the honey mushroom. Probably one of the worst forest pathogens in terms of a fungus that actually kills trees. And interestingly, some of our parasites, in fact, many of them, not only can kill the host, but can then consume the dead material after the host has passed.
And some of those parasites have parasites of their own. Isn't there an aborted entoloma mushroom that takes over a honey mushroom and basically zombies it, takes it over, turns it into something, a third thing?
Absolutely. Yikes.
Zombie mushrooms today on The Exchange. But this gets to what you talked about earlier, Dave, with fungi, the idea that, they can sort of giveth and taketh away. I mean, there's a dark side to fungi.
Well, I think people think of them as, oh, God, you know, there's mold, there's mildew, throw it away, it's in my refrigerator, it's in the vegetable bin, it looks awful.
As a PR problem, said earlier.
Right, but those are saprophytes. They're breaking down plant material. They're actually helping out recycling. I think everybody just lumps them into, like, the bad category of parasites. It sounds bad, it must be bad, but the vast majority are saprophytes that are living and taking advantage of free carbohydrates and helping to recycle those.
But we've spent a lot of time talking about the benefits of fungi. There is a downside.
Yes. In the forest, I mean, that particular one, the honey mushroom, sure, can kill trees. It grows underneath the bark. People have seen it, that black shoestring rot. When you pull off the bark, it looks like shoelaces underneath the bark, and that's infesting and growing into the cambium of a living tree and killing it. And then you'll see the fruiting body, which is the honey mushroom.
And, Rick, a lot of our listeners have heard us talk about white-nosed bat syndrome. Mm, yep. Is that a fungi?
Yes, it is, indeed. Yep. It is a fungus. It's
a fungus. Sorry, singular.
Yep.
Fungus.
Yep. Mm-hmm. It's fungus that unfortunately has taken out most of our native bat species, or at least those that summer here. So that is, it's specific to that bat. It's not unusual to have these mushrooms or these types of fungi exist, but every so often they do have what is called an outbreak based on certain types of conditions. We're still trying to understand the basis for white nose syndrome.
All right. Well, coming up, we're going to talk to a local chef who forages for his menu creations. And we'll take a lot more of your questions and comments. So keep them coming. 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. We'll be right back. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Tomorrow on our show, why many environmental groups tiptoe around the question of population. That's tomorrow on The Exchange. This hour, can fungi save mankind, or at least give us a hand with problems like climate change or world hunger? We're looking at increasing interest in these organisms these days, both on the global scale, but also on our plates. And with us now on that more local angle is Chef Evan Hennessy. He's chef and owner of The Stages at One Washington Restaurant in Dover. He forages for mushrooms for his creations. And Chef Hennessy, really nice to have you. Thank you for your time.
Well, thank you so much for having me. It's great to be here.
How many different types of mushrooms do you use in your kitchen typically?
Usually we go between 5 to 6 different, again, depending on the season and what is either brought to us or what we can find.
And has it been a good season for mushrooms?
It has been an incredible season this
really?
Year.
Really? How so?
Yeah. I think, I mean, between the weather, the cold snaps, and the rain that we're getting, you know, where I think we're also having the cycles of the mushrooms coming back around as far as how they cyclically grow. We're kind of seeing a lot sort of converging at one time, and it's just been a wonderful thing. In fact, we just have like a plethora of mushrooms right now.
So how did you learn how to forage for mushrooms? I mean, we were talking earlier. I don't know if you were able to listen. Everybody's heard you need to be careful not to pick a poisonous one. So how did you learn that?
Oh, goodness. No, you're absolutely right. You know, and that's one of the first things that you tell anybody that says, is like, oh, I'm interested in mushrooms, you know, and foraging and looking for it. The first thing you tell them is like, don't do it. You know, you really need to go out with a very experienced forager. And the people that I've spoken with and learned from have been doing this for 20, 30 years. In fact, it is their lifestyle to go out and do this. And they've eaten, a gentleman who I work with says that he has personally eaten over 160 varieties of wild mushrooms in his life. Has them all cataloged, spore printed, and whatnot in order to keep everything on track. From there, you know, I always carry books with me, and I do have two close friends that are excellent mushroom foragers. So, you know, you always sort of give them a call or take pictures and shoot them and say, you know, in your best guess, what do you think this is? And even in that scenario, we don't pick it. You take a note on it. You note the tree, the soil, and the weather, and then you kind of go back to it. You can take a spore print and see, so you've got a positive identification. Even with that being said, that I still only work personally with just a few different kinds of mushrooms. Again, because my level of mushroom foraging knowledge is very remedial compared to a lot of other people.
So
I'm still careful.
Where do you forage, or is that a trade secret?
Some people like to keep their spots very secret. My best answer to that is I like to be vague about it.
So in the area around Dover, I mean, Dover's, yeah. You know, it's, I mean, all of New Hampshire has its
of course
forests and great outdoors, yeah. But Dover isn't the great North Woods, but there's enough to keep you going just in your area?
There is, yeah. And a lot of times that I've found some of the best areas for me are, you know, wildlife sanctuaries, preserves, nature preserves, natural forests, things you know are safe and protected lands. So that's always a good place to begin. And from there, you know, I, a lot of times it kind of starts by just kind of going randomly for a walk in the woods. And we always say, you know, even a bad day foraging with not collecting any mushrooms is still a great day in the woods.
Absolutely. Yes.
You know, and so that we're able to go out and find, you know, you're speaking of the hen of the woods. I mean, I can't even tell you how many pounds of hen of the woods we've harvested already this year.
So you said it's been a good year for mushrooms.
Yeah.
Very enthusiastic there. Have you gotten a chance to try anything new this year?
Wisely, no. We were looking at different coral mushrooms this year. That's always something I'm curious about, but I'm still hesitant about because there is a toxin level in there. And again, just because I can digest something doesn't mean that one of my guests can. And owning a business is a whole other thing than just trying it personally. Whereas if I get somebody sick, that's a big problem.
Yeah, that's a big problem when you run a restaurant. So what kind of mushrooms, Chef Hennessy, do your customers seem to like the most?
The ones that they're most intrigued currently with are the lion's mane or the bear's heads.
Say that again?
A lion's mane.
Lion's mane, okay.
Yeah, or as a bear's head. It's the sort of this white, almost shaggy, thus the name, mushroom. Find it on the sides of the trees, and it's super meaty, really, really dense, almost has a scallop texture to it.
Wow. So what do you do with that? Do you make like a hamburger, like a mushroom burger?
Oh, yeah. It actually suits really well for that. You know, replace the old portobello idea.
Right.
But currently we light some juniper wood on fire, let that smolder, and then put the mushrooms over that. Reason being is that we find, you know, juniper and the different alders growing cedars and whatnot growing all around here. And so to us, it's a very makes sense kind of wood for us to grill over.
Well, so last question for you. You know better than me, being a chef means experimenting, making mistakes.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes it works out, sometimes it doesn't. What's the biggest mistake that you think you've made or that your average person makes when it comes to cooking with mushrooms?
I mean, mushrooms have such a depth of flavor, and that's one of the biggest reasons why we love to use them. They really give us a great sense of place. And they really help to shape and define our cuisine and our cooking. And there's a lot of sort of old recipes, you know, that people will sort of tend to go with as far as, you know, their mushroom uses. And I think, you know, if I could recommend anything is, you know, be a little more daring with what you're seeing. You know, try some different flavor combinations. But mushrooms are really, really versatile. I mean, we do them everything from, you know, blueberries to wild grapes to we've made sorbets out of them. We've pickled them.
Wait. Mushroom sorbet?
Oh, yes. Yeah, we did a pickled mushroom sorbet.
That doesn't sound very good.
On paper, it's a huh. But when it's paired off, you need, you know, other fats and salts and things like that. And what it does, it blends. It makes this sort of really earthy yet highly acidic cold element to a dish. So it's less looking at it as a dessert and more looking at it as another flavor vehicle.
Wow, that's quite a vehicle. So, well, Evan Hennessy, it's been really fun talking to you. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Laura. Great to talk to you.
All right, take care. That's Evan Hennessy, chef and owner of The Stages at One Washington Restaurant in Dover. And as we heard, he's pretty excited about foraging and using mushrooms in his creations. Now, guys, we've been having a bigger, sort of more serious scientific conversation about climate change and mushrooms and how they keep the earth healthy and so forth. And we couldn't live without them. And you said earlier, Rick, that, you know, without mushrooms, we're toast, basically. But what about this kind of fun angle of mushrooms that Chef Hennessy brings to the table? He says they just offer so much that we're not even really using them to their full potential.
I love the way he put that, the sort of sense of place, taste that mushrooms offer. Yeah, there are literally hundreds of good edible mushrooms.
How come we only have like three kinds in the grocery store?
Well, that's the grocery store. And, of course, you have this thing called the, you know, FDA, and you've got, of course, the food code and things that regulate unknown edible food sources from the woods. And that sort of brings up another point, and that is that you have to really know mushrooms, not just for the sake of what you're picking in the woods, but also sometimes at farmers markets where you see wild edible mushrooms for sale. It's really good to have a knowledge of, say, chicken of the woods, sulfur shelf, to know what they look like. I've actually seen jack-o'-lantern mushrooms for sale, which are poisonous. I've seen them for sale at Whole Foods. I sort of intervened in that behalf.
Holy smokes. Really? Wow.
Wasn't there a poisoning this year? Some people ate some jack-o'-lanterns.
Absolutely. There are eight people that got sick eating jack-o'-lanterns this year in New Hampshire. So very few, fortunately, have, you know, really serious consequences. But it has been known to happen. We've actually looked at certifying mushroom foragers in this state to make sure that restaurants and farmers markets are only producing edible wild mushrooms that are securely known.
And that's why I'm kind of boring. I just go for the button cap and the portobello because I'm like, I don't really want to make a mistake there.
Wait till you try some of the ones we brought today.
Yeah, and Rick did bring in a panoply of mushroom-related edibles, which we'll try a little bit later, and you can check out the picture on Instagram as well. We'll put some pictures up on our website as well. Did you want to jump in, Dave?
Well, that's the rock star side of all fungi, are the delicious edible mushrooms. And I think that's a way into the subject of the role of the whole fungal community. There's about four that I have learned and recognized, and they're always in the same sort of situation on the same kind of wood in the same time of the year after rain. And those are the ones that I'll stick to. And I go looking for those. But even not finding mushrooms, great time of year to be in the forest in the fall.
So lots of emails from our listeners. And speaking of photos of what you brought into the studio, Rick, there's lots of photos on Twitter from listeners, including from Christine, who put up a picture of a delicious pizza with hen of the wood mushrooms. Okay.
Right.
Hen of the woods. Plus hen of the wood jerky and pickles.
Oh, yeah.
Wow, Christine.
You can buy hen of the woods in the supermarket. Maitake, in the produce aisle.
Okay, and they call it hen of the woods because it tastes like chicken?
Well, there's hen of the woods right there.
Okay. So check out Christine's photos. Thanks a lot, Christine. Wow. Post your own if you want on Twitter like Christine did. Otto has a question. Are there any fungi that can be used as house or kitchen plants, presumably to eat, like kitchen herbs? It's a great question, Otto. Thank you.
Absolutely. You can buy spawn, that is the material that contains fungal mycelium, that when you add water and provide enough sunlight, it will grow mushrooms for you. You can buy those online. Oyster mushroom is a classic example of something you could grow in your kitchen. Hen of the woods, kits are now being sold.
So you really?
You can buy these, put it in your kitchen, put it in the windowsill, water it regularly, spritz it a little bit, and voila.
It's like a fungal chia pet.
Or if you live in, downtown Manchester or Nashua, and you don't have time to go out in the woods, you can grow it in your own little windowsill. That's a great question, Otto. I had not thought of that. Monica and Lee sent us an email. She says, I learned from an article that eating raw mushrooms is not a good idea. Is that true? Monica says, I wish I could take a course. If there is one, please let me know.
Yes.
So eating raw mushrooms isn't good?
It is not good. Reason being, largely, the chitinous glucans or the carbohydrates that make up the mushroom are largely indigestible without cooking. Okay.
Sometimes put them in a salad. Okay.
Well, you won't do that anymore. You can do that with the store-bought sort of, what they call button mushroom.
Right.
They also sell these long, thin straw mushrooms called enoki. That's a good edible wild mushroom. But generally speaking, mushrooms have adapted to different climatic conditions that force them to grow very tough and very sort of, rigorous carbohydrate exteriors. You got to break it down. You got to cook it in order to assimilate the nutrients that are latent within the mushrooms.
That's interesting. So it's not like it's going to kill you or hurt you, but it's just harder to digest.
No, unless you have multiple stomachs. Deer eat a lot of mushrooms that we can't eat that are poisonous to us that they are able to process. I mean, mushrooms are a really important wildlife food. And in a year like this with no acorns in the forest, I was watching mice and squirrels and deer feeding heavily on the tremendous bounty of mushrooms that we had this year.
Oh, that's really interesting. And I'm glad you brought that up because it isn't just people who like to eat mushrooms.
Oh, it's wildlife food.
And since the acorns, like we had that mast year last year, which we've talked about, Dave.
Right. The squirrel apocalypse.
Yeah, the squirrel apocalypse and the bears everywhere. So mushrooms are kind of picking up the slack.
Well, to the extent that they were available, and now they're under the snow, particularly today. But Rick pointed out he just picked those oyster mushrooms off a tree last week in Maine, and I'm sure there was snow on the ground there at the time.
Yes, there was.
So here's an email from Tom, and all these emails are great, so thanks, everybody. Tom says, when a person buys bare root plant stock, does that mean you're trying to plant something without any of the supporting cast of mycelium? Yeah. That you're starting the plant off with a definite deficit?
Yeah, it's actually true. Bare root stock typically has root hairs that have mycorrhiza within them.
What is bare root stock?
Bare root stock is like you're buying a small tree, for example, that has no soil around the roots. Okay, and it comes wrapped in sort of a plastic. It's really moist. And so you can buy these bare root stock trees, shrubs, and plant them out. But typically, don't forget, even seeds, if you buy tree seeds that you plant, they will have fungal spores or little bits of mycelium around the seed coat that will allow those mycorrhiza to start growing immediately with those tree seedlings. So you typically have that, but it is better if you do want to plant something that vigorously takes off, plant it with soil already around the roots.
A couple more questions I'd love to get to. Henry emails, are mushroom species ranges expanding with climate change, i.e. are species usually considered as southeast mushrooms spreading into the northeast over time? And Henry says, what can be said for global spore dispersal over time? Now, this is a great question. And Dave, we hear about this with trees, for example, that certain species that we always thought of as southern species are starting to creep up into the northeast.
Well, a great example of spore distribution is, where can you not find spores? You can go to the South Pole in Antarctica and you can find the spores of the fungus that causes chestnut blight. So there's no there's no place a chestnut tree can hide from that fungus that causes the chestnut blight. So they're ubiquitous. There is a spore culture on everything. On us right now, sitting in the studio, we have spores of fungal.
With climate change predictions, Dave or Rick, do people expect to find different species here in New England than we used to have?
For a good example is what is called the death cap. Amanita phalloides used to never occur in New England, and we had an occurrence about 25 years ago in Connecticut, a woman who got poisoned by eating the death cap. Fortunately, she survived, but what we learned from that was that, in fact, this mushroom that was previously unknown from the northeast had started to occur there, and that has actually been found as far north as southern Maine. So we're seeing those mushrooms coming in.
Last question from our listeners, and this is from Bill, and I love this, so thank you, Bill. Bill says, can you clarify the pronunciation? Is it fungi with a hard G, fun guy, or with a soft G, fun G? And if it is fun G, why is fungus pronounced fungus and not fungus? So.
You say tomato, I say tomato.
Since Dave and I are
fungus. Singular is fungus.
We're fun guys.
We like to have
right?
fun.
That's right. But you're not fungi.
I say fungi. No.
Yeah.
I just say fungi.
Yeah, I say fungi.
Well, and you're the fungi guy.
And
so.
Then fungus. I don't
fungus
know.
Fungus is singular.
Right.
Okay.
I have no idea why.
Okay. Yeah. No, well, no. It's Latin and English is a beautiful and complicated language. So,
just like mushrooms.
Bill, I love the point. So, last question, guys. As we said before, you know, the vast majority of fungi are unfamiliar or completely unknown to science. Dave, what would you like to know if you could just flip a switch and know something about fungi right now?
I think I would like to know more people are walking in the forest and appreciating open land and how incredibly fortunate we are to have natural environments that are not paved over and changed the way it is not too far south of us. And we should appreciate the opportunities we have in New Hampshire to eat and forage and admire and take photos and post on social media the tremendous fungal diversity.
How about you, Rick, real quick?
Just simply that people take mushrooms off the blacklist and elevate them with great respect.
All right. Both of you, thank you so much. This has been really fun. I'm not even going to make a joke there.
Making me hungry.
Thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate it. That's Dave Anderson, Senior Director of Education at the Forest Society, and Rick Vanderpoel, amateur mycologist, president of the Northeast Mycological Federation, and principal at Ecosystem Management Consultants. You're listening to The Exchange on NHPR.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you liked what you heard, spread the word. Give us a review on Apple Podcasts to help other listeners find us. And thanks.